I had a bad breakup in seminary, and it was not a great relationship. It was good when it ended. It wasn't good how I ended it. But later on, I was very broken. I was incredibly sad. I have not shed so many tears in my entire life except during that period. I realized the Lord had a lot of work to do in me. I had some relationship patterns, ways of doing things that weren't helpful if I was to have a long-term marriage. And I got depressed, and it was terrible, a terrible time. But I finally got some counsel, went and saw a counselor, and he began to help me to realize how I was doing things was not the best, and eventually began to establish some new ways of relating. Well, I continued to go to school, though I didn't take as many classes, and I one day happened to notice a cute girl with long, curly brown hair with a bounce in her step, but I knew I wasn't ready for anything yet. I still had some stuff to work on. And so I remember at some point talking to a couple of my really good friends and saying, guys, I've known you for a long time. This last relationship, I just kept pressing ahead without checking in with you, and I was dumb. I need some help. Here's what I'm going to do, guys. I don't think I should even look at a girl for about a year. And then when I finally feel like I've worked on my stuff, I want to talk to you about it, and then I still have to wait a month. And then maybe it's time. Will you guys do that for me? I said, sure. So I worked on my stuff. I noticed Kim, but I thought, no, it's not time. It's not time. I don't want to mess that one up too. So eventually, a year passed, and I was feeling really good about things. Well, I lived in a house with about four or five other guys, and one of my new housemates, we went on a bike ride, hopped on our bikes, rode through Portland, went to a park, and I was just about to ask him a little bit about Kim, because he had been in the same first-year class with her, and I was about to say, tell me about when he said, hey, I want to tell you about this girl I like. Oh, no! I'm thinking to myself, I am not creating this inner house rivalry. I'm not doing that. Well, unbeknownst to me, he had indicated interest in either she wasn't interested in him in particular or men at the time in general. It wasn't the time. A number of months went by, and I never heard a word about them. And so I felt like, okay, Lord, I think it could be time now. And so I went to my buddies and said, I've worked on these things and these things. I've grown up in a few areas. Yeah, I know I still have a million miles to go, but I came a little ways. And all right, now I got to wait a month, right? They said, yeah, that's what you said. Okay. Well, a month went by, and I met with them. I said, guys, I think I'm ready. And, oh, that's when it got hard. You know, picking up that phone. Oh, that was scary. But I had work to do, and as it turned out, she had gone through some stuff too, and it wasn't time until that day in early February, goodness, almost 20 years ago, and I'm so grateful. I'm grateful because God had finally taught me a little patience, at least in that area, though to be honest, I still struggle with my patience a lot. My mind goes a million miles an hour. I have a million ideas. I don't necessarily think really quick on my feet, but I got a lot of ideas. I've never met a set of stairs that I don't run up. I don't know why. I see stairs and I go. That's just me. And you hopefully, well, you've seen that for good and bad. I still struggle with patience. But the Lord keeps telling me, you got to wait on me. You got to move at my pace. And I've got a little thing I wrote above my desk. Wait on the Lord. Okay, he'll do things in his time. And we're about to launch into Ruth chapter 3. And this is very much a wait on the Lord, because God had a lot of work to do in every single participant in this story. We started Ruth a few weeks ago, and we saw that the first chapter, everyone had a choice to make. Her father-in-law had taken her mother-in-law and two sons down to Moab. There was a famine. There was no bread in Bethlehem, the house of bread. They'd gone away. Eventually, the father-in-law died. Her sons got married. They died. And then it was time, okay, what are we going to do? We hear rumors of food back in Bethlehem. Let's go back. And so Naomi said to Orpah and Ruth, you may go back. You know, go back to your father's house. Hopefully you can find rest in the house of someone else. You'll get married, have a family, be okay, go back to your gods. Orpah said, okay. After weeping a little bit, Ruth said, I'm going to stick with you. Your people will be my people. Your God will be my God. I'm choosing to follow the God of Israel, and I will be committed to you. They arrive in Bethlehem. The very next day, harvest season begins. Ruth says, we've got to eat. So she goes out and takes advantage of the laws of the land of Israel, which say that as you are harvesting your grain, don't pick up everything. Don't harvest to the very edge of the field, because that was their system of welfare. The poor could move into the field. They could pick what was left over. Well, Ruth goes, and she just happens to, not knowing, she ends up in the field of a relative of Naomi. And this gentleman happens to be a wonderful, godly man. And he takes notice of Ruth, and the workers in his field say, wow, she's a hard worker. We've heard about her. She came with Naomi. Word traveled fast. They just got there the day before. I don't know how this happened. But he provides. He says, listen, share my lunch. Hang out with my workers. He says, guys, I want you to treat this foreigner, this lady named Ruth, this Moabitess, very well. Don't hassle her, or else make life easy for her. She brings home a whole bunch of grain. And Naomi's like, where have you been? She says, well, as a matter of fact, I ended up in the field of this guy named Boaz. You ever heard of him? Have I heard of him? Oh my goodness, we're related to him. He could be our ticket out of here, is what Naomi is thinking. But she says, this is good. Stick around. Keep going to his field just like he invited you to. And Ruth did that for the next 6-7 weeks, couple months. And she lives with her mother-in-law. Well, we get to chapter 3. What is going to happen? It's the end of harvest season. They're threshing out the grain. And Naomi comes to Ruth with a very interesting command, proposal, set of instructions. Here's what she says. My daughter, should I not seek rest for you that it may be well with you? She's not saying, Ruth, I want you to take a nap. Rest is a term used throughout this book. In chapter 1, it was like, seek rest in the home of another husband, protection, a place of safety. Later on, at the end of verse 18 in chapter 3, she's going to say, this man will not rest till he's figured things out. Naomi is saying, listen, Ruth, you're young. You need to get married. I want what's best for you. I want it to be well with you. And so Naomi is going to have a very interesting way of going about it. And at first glance, it's really going to seem like a scandalous proposal. What in the world is going on? But Ruth has put her hands in the lives of Naomi. She has submitted herself, saying, I'm going to stick with you. We're going to learn about waiting on God, and we're going to see that Ruth is waiting on God, and she is responsive. Waiting on God sometimes involves responsiveness. And this is what Naomi says in verse 2 of chapter 3. Is not Boaz our relative with whose young women you were? See, he is winnowing barley tonight on the threshing floor. Wash therefore, anoint yourself, put on your cloak, go down to the threshing floor, but don't make yourself known to the man until he's finished eating and drinking. But when he lies down, observe the place where he lies. Then go, uncover his feet and lie down, and he will tell you what to do. And she replied, all you say I will do. After the harvest, you gathered up all the grain and you beat it with a stick. And then usually the threshing floors were in a higher place where there was more likely a chance of wind. You beat the grain out, you toss it in the air, and the wind blows the chaff away. And this is probably a place where it was hard-packed clay, because you really don't want to do your threshing in the sand. That just doesn't bake good bread. But it was a time, after the harvest, a time of celebration. We've had a great harvest. Here it all is. Thank you, Father, for taking good care of us. But the reason they're going to be there at night as partially the winds blow. Partially, this is a great time if you're a lazy thief to get a bunch of grain. Wow, I didn't have to plant. I didn't have to harvest. I didn't have to beat it out. All I had to do was sneak up and steal it. And so people would spend the night there because that was literally your life. And Naomi has this, and so she says, wash and anoint yourself, put on your cloak, go down to the threshing floor. Well, at first glance, it sounds like, put on your Midnight of Moab, you know, just so, and put on your slinky dack dress and make yourself attractive. I don't think that's what she's saying at all, partially because it's going to be dark. She's not going to see what kind of dress she's got on, though the perfume is not going to hurt. She's not going to be seen. But what I think is really going on is she is saying, your time of mourning is over. If you were to look in, I think it's 2 Samuel, after David's son dies, he rises, he takes a bath, he anoints himself with oil, he changes his clothes, and then he gets on with life and he eats and drinks. There's another passage in Isaiah that is talking about how you put off the old, put on the new. I think what Naomi is saying is, Ruth, you were a faithful daughter-in-law. You have been faithful to your husband. You have mourned him long enough. And she's being sensitive. She's not just get over him. She's, now it's time to go forward. You don't need to wear your old mourning clothes. It's time for a new beginning. You've waited. But then she says, don't make yourself known until he's finished eating and drinking. Obviously, they've spent a long day at work. They're going to be tired. They're going to eat well. They will drink. Yes, there was alcohol. That's what they did because the water wasn't any good. But there's no indication whatsoever that Boaz is going to be drunk. And as we're going to see, there's going to be a real contrast between Lot and his daughter, when she got him drunk, and that's how the Moabites came about, and this particular Moabitess. There's not going to be a hint of carrying on in a bad way. But she says, don't make yourself known. When he lies down, observe where he lies. This is going to be really critical. You don't want to get him mixed up with one of the other guys there. Go uncover his feet, lie down. He'll tell you what to do. And Ruth replies, all you say I will do. Fascinating. At first glance, I'm reading this, I go, what in the world is Naomi thinking? Remember, this is the time of the judges. Every man did what was right in his own eyes, and he did what was right wrong in his own eyes too. Men have always done the wrong thing, so have women. And it almost sounds like Naomi is setting up this midnight whatever at the harvest floor. And in fact, if you look in Isaiah, it talks about prostitution, and it talks about going on at the threshing floor. And you're thinking, why is Naomi sending her daughter-in-law into a potentially very dangerous situation? This sounds compromising, and it very well could be. And in fact, the judges was not a time of great morals. And after all, a guy harvested, he's worked hard, he's got his whole year's paycheck right there. Some woman of the night comes, there you go. What is going to happen? Why is she doing this? We don't know all the cultural background, though I know Naomi knows what kind of woman Ruth is. She also knows what kind of man Boaz is. And somehow, this is culturally appropriate, though I am not going to recommend it to my own daughter. This is really a strange situation, but Naomi has proven to be trustworthy at this point. She has had a real heart change. And Ruth says, okay. Verse 6, so she went down to the threshing floor and did just as her mother-in-law had commanded to her. Okay, Mom, off I go. She was waiting on God. She demonstrated utter reliability. She had submitted herself to Naomi as a proper authority. She admitted herself to God, and when Naomi says go, she said okay. She did exactly what she was asked. She didn't add or take away. And we read in verse 7 that Boaz is, he's eaten and drunk, and his heart is merry. He's like, life is good. The Lord has provided. Because Boaz lived in Bethlehem a long time. He remembered the days of famine. He remembered the days of hardship. Now, God has provided. Plus, there is, I believe, some stirrings in his heart. He has spent the last 6, 7, 8 weeks observing a young foreigner with amazing character who has exhibited incredible love for her mother-in-law. And clearly, Boaz has been paying attention. Well, he lays down at the end of the heap of grain. Ruth, in verse 7, comes softly and uncovered his feet and lay down. I think what's happening is basically she pulls that up, and if Boaz is like me, my feet get cold. And if you're laying outside, it gets nippy. And eventually, he's going to wake up. Now, at my house, it's Kim who throws the covers off, and I grab them because I run cold. And so that's what she's doing, what her mother-in-law said. It doesn't say she pulled the blanket over she and Boaz and the snuggle fest was on. It doesn't say that whatsoever. The Bible, as you know, is very clear about sexual encounters. It is not squeamish in the least little bit. The Bible goes on and on, sometimes into much more detail than we would like. It talks about illicit things, but you're not going to get a hint. The situation, the context sounds a little wacky, I admit, but there will be no hint of either of these people doing anything wrong. So she lies down. She's at his feet. At midnight, verse 8, the man was startled, turned over, and behold, a woman at his feet. What a surprise! What is he thinking? What is he going to think? What will he do? I know some folks who were truckers in the past, and they'd be asleep at the truck stop, dead to the world, and all of a sudden there was a rap on the window. And they open their eyes and look, and there's a girl. Some of them said, beat it. Some of them said, come on in. These are choices. What is he going to do? But he says, who are you? He may not have recognized the perfume smell. He probably didn't. But it's dark. He's in a deep sleep. And she says, I am Ruth, your servant. Earlier in chapter 2, she's called the Moabitess, the one from Moab, over and over and over. And she says, how is it that even though I'm not your servant, you're treating me like a servant? Here she says, I'm your servant. They have gotten to know each other, albeit from a distance. But the word has gotten out. She knows from Naomi who Boaz is. Obviously, she knows from working for him that he is a good man. And she makes an interesting statement. Spread your wings over your servant, for you are a redeemer. Spread your wings over your servant, for you are a redeemer. In a very real sense, she repeats to him what he had said to her. If you were to look in chapter 2, verse 12, it said, the Lord repay you for what you've done, and a full reward be given you by the Lord, the God of Israel, under whose wings you have come to take refuge. He knew that she had come seeking protection from the God of Israel. And now she is saying, you, as a man of God, as an Israelite who is right with God, marry me. How strange. We have a woman proposing to a man. We have a foreigner proposing to an Israelite. We have a poor lady talking to a rich man. But this, even to our eyes, our reading sounds strange, but this is appropriate. She is saying, I know who you are. I know what you are like. You are in a position to do something. And you know what? She is taking Ruth or Naomi at her word because she's already seen Boaz's character. He had protected her. He had provided. And so she knew, she had to be pretty certain that he would be willing to take this step. But let me tell you, there is a risk involved. When we got to wait on God, there is a risk. You know? What is going to happen? He may shoo her off and say, oh, I thought you were great. Now you show up at midnight. What do you want? What are you trying to do? Be gone, lady. Maybe he's going to say, you know what? I've been kind to you, but I really don't want to be that kind. I don't want to marry you. Because as we're going to find out, Boaz knows what the responsibilities are. He's aware of the personal cost to himself. Some say, well, why would Naomi send her in this way? Well, they say, well, I don't know why they didn't, Naomi didn't just kind of walk along and catch him while he was walking out of the fields. But there's a chance that maybe she's saying, Ruth, go ask him at a time where others won't hear, so you won't embarrass him if he doesn't want to take this step. Because if you go back to Deuteronomy 25, there are very clear laws on what a widow should do. If a widow's husband dies and she has no children, she's to go to her husband's brother and say, marry me. And if he won't, then she's to go to the elders of the city and say, my husband's brother won't do his duty. He won't marry me and give me an heir so that my husband will have his name will last. And Deuteronomy 25 says, if the man won't do it, then she's to spit on him, take off her sandal, and give him a whack, basically. And he's to be called the man without a sandal or something like that. He's like, wow, that doesn't sound like the greatest insult in the world. But I remember seeing pictures after the fall of Baghdad. They pulled down all the statues of Saddam Hussein. And like old guys were getting their sandals and beating on his head. So that must have been an insult. But she says, you are a redeemer. You can do something about my situation. Remember, if he does something about Ruth's situation, it will also do something about Naomi's. But I'm convinced, looking at verse number one, should I not seek rest for you, it will go well with you. I think Naomi was putting Ruth first at this point. She had seen how much Ruth had put her first. But Ruth knows if Boaz redeems her, if he marries her, it will also provide for Naomi. I'm convinced there's nothing wrong going on because you look in verse 10. A spontaneous prayer meeting breaks out on the threshing floor. May you be blessed by the Lord, my daughter. Boaz is committed to righteousness. He's been waiting on the Lord as well. We're going to see that he couldn't take action until this point because of what he's about to say, but he's committed to righteousness. Ruth is responsive. She's reliable. She's taking a huge risk, but she's still waiting on the Lord. And he says, blessed my daughter. Naomi uses that my daughter twice in that chapter. Obviously, there is a tremendous age difference. But yet he says, do not fear. You have made this last kindness greater than the first, in that you have not gone after young men, whether poor or rich. He knows what Ruth did for her mother-in-law. She gave of herself. She was committed. And that was the first kindness. The second kindness is, wow, Boaz is going, you're going to bless me with the opportunity of marrying you. And he says, now, my daughter, do not fear. I will do for you all that you ask. For all my fellow townsmen know that you are a worthy woman. Boaz in chapter 2 is called a worthy man. Isn't this interesting? Man, woman, foreigner, local, rich, poor, and yet character-wise, they are both worthy, and everyone sees that. I think that's partially why Naomi was willing to take this step. Everyone knows who you are. In verse 12, and now it's true, I am a redeemer. I can do something about this. I want to do something about this. And I think we know he wants to do something about it because he's already checked into it. Here's the problem. There is a redeemer nearer than I. And yet we're going to see that Boaz is committed to righteousness. He is going to do the right thing. He's not going to force the issue beyond the bounds it is okay to do. He says, remain here tonight and in the morning. If he will redeem you, good, let him do it. Kind of like when my housemate said, hey, I'm kind of interested in. I had to say, okay, it's not my call to make right now. But he goes, listen, there is this other one who is a closer relative. It may have been that Boaz was a distant cousin. Do it, but not willing to redeem you. Then as the Lord lives, I solemnly swear I will redeem you. Then he says, lie down till morning. So she lay at his feet until the morning, but arose before one could recognize another. And he said, let it not be known the woman came to the threshing floor. Even though it sounds strange to us, he is protecting her reputation. She is not your typical Moabitess going to the threshing floor in the middle of the night at harvest time. Also, I think he wants to protect his own reputation. There was nothing to fear. He had done nothing wrong, but it looked a little strange. A couple of my best friends, when they were going to get engaged, he thought it would be so fun to ride the train. And he'd heard how you could get this little private car, and it'd be so romantic. And so they went from Seattle to Portland, I believe. Anyway, the steward came in and brought them their meals, and it was a great time. They were just on there a few hours, I think. And anyway, the steward came in and started to pull down the bed. And the gal said, "Oh, no, no, we won't be sleeping." And then the steward went, "Oh, because I know what you'll be doing." And then she went, "No, no, 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 not that either, not that either." They hadn't even put the dots together. They were just thinking, "Oh, it'll be so fun to have our own little room." They weren't thinking it was a sleeper car, and they're about to get engaged. And they're like, "Ah, no, we didn't do anything wrong." But the steward is like, "Oh, yeah, I know what's happening down there." But others might be thinking things, but nothing that was wrong was happening in my friend's life or in with Boaz and Ruth. Before she leaves, he gives her a reward, in a sense. It's an R word, sorry. "Let not be known." The woman came to the threshing floor, and he said, "Bring the garment you're wearing and hold it out." He gives her 6 measures, whatever that equals to. She goes back into the city. When she gets there, her mother-in-law has not slept all night. "How did it go? How did you fare, my daughter?" Really what she's saying is, "Are you going to be Mrs. Boaz?" "Oh, I hope so." She is excited. You know, it's like the house my bride lived in with the 7 ladies in seminary. One of them would come home from a date, and they'd all gather. I think they did this. They'd gather around, "How did it go?" And they, to be honest, that happened at my house with all the guys too, but just a little more manly style. But he said, "How did it go?" And she goes, "Well, here's a bunch of grain for you." And I think what's going on is not only is he providing for them, but in a sense, that could be a dowry, a bride price. It could be, listen, this is just the first of what's to come. Whether Ruth got it or not, Naomi certainly went, "Woohoo! Dun, 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 dun." And so she's excited. Naomi has already been thinking about chapter 4 for a long time. But this is the kind of guy Boaz is. He says, "You must not go empty-handed back to your mother-in-law." Boaz is thinking about her. And then the word that's a killer. She replied, "Wait. Wait, my daughter, until you learn how the matter turns out. For the man will not rest, but will settle the matter today." I want to find, shouldn't I seek rest for you? The man will not rest. Wait. They've got to show some restraint. She's not going to say, "Okay, he is going to go down to the city gate tomorrow, and if there's only 7 elders, Ruth, I want you to go down and round up 3 more. Come on, guys, get down to the city gate so he can make a decision." She's got to wait. And, oh, it is hard. I don't know what decisions you're facing, but you may be having to wait on some things. I was talking to a friend just this week, and he said, "We're wanting to move from Arkansas back to Oregon. We want to sell the house. I don't know if it's going to take the Lord 2 weeks or 2 years. We'll wait. It'll be his time." I know some of you are wanting to sell houses. Some of you maybe have other big decisions. And it's hard to know, when do you take that step? When don't you? Over and over in the scripture, though, we read about how waiting on God, he knows what he's doing. "Wait on the Lord. Be of good courage. He will strengthen your heart. I will instruct you and teach you in the way you should go. I will guide you with my eye." This is not easy. The waiting time comes. You can summarize the book of Ruth that she starts out weeping, then she's working. Now she's waiting. Next week it'll get really good for the wedding, but wait and how it turns out. Why didn't Boaz take the initiative? Because he knew there was someone first in line. He also knew that it might look a little strange if this sweet young thing from Moab comes back and this well-established man takes the initiative to go after her. Why did Naomi wait? Because she wanted to see the character of Boaz, because she didn't know. She already knew the character of Naomi. And why is Ruth waiting? Because her mourning wasn't over. When the authority in her life had said go, she was willing to go. It's difficult. But if we're doing what the Lord would have us do, doing it His way in righteousness, He will bless us. It may not be in this life, it could be in the life to come, but He will take care of things. We don't have to force things. I have the tendency to, I want to make this happen. I want to grease the slide. And I keep thinking, trust in the Lord with all your heart. Lean not on your own understanding. In all your ways acknowledge Him. He'll direct your paths. It doesn't say, make your own path. When I run ahead of God, things don't go well. Let me encourage you, whatever the Lord's having you wait on, if you have chosen Him, if you've taken refuge in Him, you can trust that at the due time, it will work out. Oh, I guess it was the late 70s, early 80s. There used to be commercials for Paul Masson wines. You'd see them on TV, and there would be Orson Welles, I think, was the spokesman. He'd be sitting there with a glass of wine and classical music playing, and he would extol the virtues of how Paul Masson wine is finely crafted. It uses the best grapes in the world, aged in the most perfect fashion, the right temperature, and they have the most seasoned testers to know exactly when it is suitable for sale. And so he goes on and he says, and what you need to know is what we at Paul Masson Wine have known for over 100 years. And then he says, we will sell no wine before its time. In this booming great voice. And I thought about that. We will sell no wine before its time. Wine takes time to age. You can't rush it. It takes a while. But when it's ready, it's good. And the longer you wait, the better it gets. Ruth and Naomi and Boaz did not short-circuit God's work. They didn't rush things, but in God's good time, when it was revealed, go, they went. Whatever you're wrestling with, ask Him, should I keep waiting, Lord, or is it time to move? And He will direct your steps. Let's pray.